Waltz is loading that. I'd like to thank everyone for being here this morning, and it's sort of a continuation of Catherine Browder-Gervey's work. We're also looking at the whole issue of obesity and overweight and potential risk associated with this important biomarker of health and how this might transition youth into adulthood with potential risk factors. So I'd like to acknowledge that my good colleague Breanne Davis is not here today because she had a baby. She was supposed to do this presentation. This would have been her first one. So, Bree, if you're listening out there, I hope I do as good a job as you would have done. And I'm hoping the baby's doing well, too. So, there are no financial disclosures in this particular study. Just as an introduction, there are three major points here. We're really looking at the accurate estimation of body composition in youth with disabilities. And I have to preface this by saying that there's been a very small amount of work in this area, but I would like to recognize a woman who's put a lot of emphasis into this in the early 1990s, Dr. Linda Bandini from the University of Massachusetts, has done a lot of work with obesity and really started to look at obesity and the accuracy of BMI almost 20 years ago. There just hasn't been a lot done since then. So we're starting to pick up with that with a grant that we received from NIDA called an Obesity Drip Disability Rehabilitation Research Project, and try to get at how can we better measure it and try to come up with measures that are simple enough to use so that youth with disabilities can get somewhat of an accurate measure of their body fat as a proxy through some kind of non-invasive measure. As we know, body composition is really an essential component of a physical exam or as a marker of health, a biomarker of health, and if we can't get a good measure of that, then it's hard to get a good trajectory of health in later life. Obesity assessment, as we all know, is very important in transition age youth because, as you know, when youth get into adulthood, obesity tracks well from adolescence into adulthood. It's a good predictor of obesity in adulthood. How do we measure body composition? There are a number of ways. It's kind of amazing that I started in this area in 1979 and did the first study using underwater weighing in adults with, at that time, called mental retardation at the State School for the Mentally Retarded back in 79. And I wrote a paper actually in 75 about the growing rate of obesity in my undergraduate program at Queens College. So we're still, incurring the same issues with, obesity being a problem. It has just gotten worse. So there are other techniques, magnetic resonance imaging or MRI, computed axial tomography, doubly labeled water, which we used to use a lot in the 70s and the 80s, but it's very costly and very hard to do. And of course, DEXA, or dual x-ray absorptiometry, is really the gold standard today on how you get a really good estimate of body composition, including body fat. The pros, obviously, they're highly accurate assessments, but very costly and time-consuming. So the gold standard measure of a proxy of body fat, which is what we're really getting at here, we're not looking at other compartments of tissues like bone and residual tissue, connective tissue, and muscle, but we really want to look at what is the ratio of fat to the rest of the tissue. And the measure that we use in epidemiology is body mass index. It requires little skill to do. It costs nothing. And it does provide a reasonably accurate estimate about adiposity in the general population. The difficulties associated with BMI in individuals with mobility limitations, and Catherine mentioned this earlier, is that it's really hard to get a good measure of height in youth who have some level of spasticity or contractures. And the other problem is if you get out to most institutions, you'll rarely find a wheelchair accessible scale in many hospitals or clinics. So if someone has a need to be measured in a seated position, you have to obviously get them out of the chair, weigh the chair, and then weigh them and the chair together in order to get an accurate measure of weight. And there are very few places around the country where you can get a wheelchair accessible scale, unless you're in a situation like we were, where we've got this nice partnership with Shriners Hospital in Chicago, and they have several wheelchair accessible scales. So this is a partnership with them. The purpose being, what is the level of agreement between BMI and skin folds? So our sample was, we were hoping to get 60, and we're still struggling to get that. But you can imagine that individuals who come to Shriners for care don't stay there for very long. They might come from various geographic areas, and then they're there for a short period of time, and they leave. So schedule issues of getting a large sample are very complex, and we're not on campus, on the Shriners campus. We're at the University of Illinois Chicago, so there's a little bit of a logistical issue, but we're working towards a number of 60 so we can come up with some type of a prediction equation. So we currently have 29, and that's our age range, 14 to 17, as you can see here. 17 males, 12 females, and we have 5 with cerebral palsy, 21 with spinal cord injury, and 3 with spina bifida. I'll show you some of that data in a minute. So we compared body weight status by 3 measurements, BMI, tricep skin fold, and the DEXA scan. And tricep skin fold years ago, again, when I was doing a lot of body composition work in the 70s and 80s, was really the gold standard for classifying youth as having a level of weight that was a health risk. And you don't see as much of it anymore, but there are still some norm reference data. I think even Henhans, don't they use tricep skin fold?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Well, I think they use tricep skin fold in a couple other norm reference population-based data sets. So the procedure is BMI. We have height, which we measured recumbent by Shriner staff, who are pretty good at measuring this, so we have fairly good reliability with that. Weight was measured by the Shriner staff as well, and then we used tricep skin fold and DEXA. The classification criteria was typical of, what you see in youth is obese greater than 95th percentile, 85th to 94th, and then healthy weight was considered under the 84th percentile. And I apologize, I couldn't get this to come out in a lighter color. But what's interesting about this slide is in these 29 youth, you can see that there seems to be a very good correlation between the DEXA percent body fat and BMI, right? So if you took this, this graph, you'd say, I think BMI is going to do okay on a population basis because it looks like it's a nice correlation, 0.734 significant at the 0.01 level. But when you get in, you look at the number of false positives and false negatives, it's striking to see that if you look at BMI, right, and using DEXA as the reference standard, we had a total out of 7 of the 23 youth that fell into these 3 categories. The blue is healthy weight, the orange is overweight status, and the green is obese. You can see that there were 17 of the 23 youth had a false negative. In other words, they were obese, but they were, according to BMI, healthy, in the healthy weight category. And of course, here you can see it in more detail. Here's a false negative for the overweight. And then we have false negatives that we found, if this is interesting, if a youth was obese, significantly obese, they were obese either on BMI or DEXA. And then using tricep skin fold, almost the same results. 13 of the 19 participants were false negatives. They were broken up this fashion. And then when we get into the overweight category, once again, 5 out of 6 were false negatives, and 0 out of the 9 who are overweight, or I should say obese, were false negatives. And then, this is sort of just a proxy here of how we looked at the data individually. And you can see again, in the red, these are all the false negatives. So you take, for example, here's a youth, male, 17 years of age, has a BMI of 19.8, which is in the healthy category. But when you get into the obesity category, he has a body fat level of 34.2%. Which is obviously significantly higher or high in the obesity category. And then, the data on CP is interesting. I don't know if you've seen the data on CP, but for the most part, a lot of people say that, that there's a problem with underweight, and there is. But with CP, cerebral palsy, you have to sort of break out the population into ambulatory and non-ambulatory. And generally speaking, those that are non-ambulatory usually do fall into the underweight category. But when you just look at a couple of youth here, and let me pick out a dramatic one. If you take this youth here, this 17-year-old had a BMI of 22.1, right, which fell into the healthy category, less than the 85th percentile. But his body fat was 39.1%, which is, again, we're using, the criteria of 25 or 30. And that's argued, when you get into the DEXA literature, you can see that this is a dramatically higher number than, what one would anticipate. Obtaining with a measure of BMI. Another example here, here's a young girl with spina bifida, 14 years of age, BMI 21.3, and a body fat level of 45.7. I want to just point this out because, again, this is all, preliminary data, but if you look at the population of youth with spina bifida and adults with spina bifida, the obesity rates are staggering. And the data that we've collected, we've got more than three participants. We're also conducting another study with a large sample. BMIs are generally higher and they fall into the overweight category. But when you actually measure body composition, these numbers are staggering. So it's a population in particular that we need to pay a little bit more attention to. Now, obviously, the limitations of a lot of research is that we don't have a large enough sample size to be able to develop a regression equation or a prediction equation to look at this in a more non-invasive way. High number of SCI, we had a much higher rate of youth with spinal cord injuries because it was difficulty obtaining DEXA scans on youth with spasticity. So if we couldn't get a measure, then we were excluded from the study, unfortunately, and we had to do that on several occasions. And they had to lie still. That was the other thing with the DEXA. You know, if someone has spasticity or they have aphthotoid cerebral palsy where there's a little bit of a movement, you can't get a good scan. So the DEXA doesn't work real well for people who have some sort of a tremor. They cannot sit still for several minutes. And the convenience of those participating in Shriners inpatient clinics for SCI. So they have a couple of summer programs where they bring in youth with SCI into these summer camps. And we kind of tapped into that for potential subjects. So the takeaway points today are really to sort of get you engaged in this research and see if there's something you want to pick on or pick off what we're doing. And that's, one is there's a considerable support for the use of BMI in the public health literature and in epidemiology studies. And that's great because obviously we're not going to have these invasive techniques anytime soon. But as an index for overweight and obesity, the BMI cutoff significantly underestimated obesity in youth with SCI and other physical disabilities, and a single measure of body composition, such as BMI, may not accurately estimate obese adiposity. There is a need to better understand the relationship between BMI and percent body fat in order to develop appropriate criteria for defining adolescents with physical disabilities as overweight and obese, and validation of simple, low-cost, height and weight-based indices are really needed in this population. And in conclusion, I'd like to say that there's a very promising study that just came out this year, I don't know if you've seen it yet, Catherine, where they've actually used neck circumference as a proxy of adiposity, and they found highly significant correlations with DEXA scans. So, again, it's the first study that's come out to really show that one measure of neck circumference really can do a fairly good job at predicting accuracy of obesity rates. So thank you.
Oh, you're done.